Hey, everybody. I want to open today's show with a clip of Georgia Senator Nancy Schaefer discussing corruption in child protective services and the family court system over 10 years ago. And while Schaefer's views do not perfectly reflect the views of today's guest, her concerns and statements here shed light on just a microcosm of an expanding nationwide problem.
Caseworkers and social workers are often guilty of fraud. They withhold and destroy evidence, and they seek wrongly to terminate parental rights while being protected by state immunity. There is a huge bureaucracy made up of judges, court-appointed attorneys, guardian ad litems, social workers, state employees, court investigators, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, foster parents, adoptive parents, and on, who are looking to the children in state care for their job security. Judges have control over private living arrangements and income of 48.3 million Americans. The United States Census Bureau reported in 2002 that $40 billion in transfer payments were made between households of custody parents and other parents. That money, $40 billion, is under the direction and control of family court judges. In environments covered with confidentiality laws that protect the wrong people. Fathers are victims of this unjust system. Child support payments, even without having visits with their children, are choking the very life out of fathers. Three fathers, of whom I am aware and have been in touch with, committed suicide in the last 12 months because they lost the opportunity to even visit with their children. These are crimes against humanity for financial gain. Rights are removed from parents, human rights, civil rights, and even religious rights. One illustration of what took place in my district is that after so many calls, I decided to call a meeting in one of the counties of my own district. I personally called 37 families that had been in touch with me who had all lost their children, grandchildren. I had them meet me in the library one Saturday morning. We started at 9 o'clock and we ended at 9 o'clock. We had 50 families standing outside the door that could not get in. We didn't have time to talk with them. There was incredible anguish and profound suffering from these families. Some children had been taken off the school bus, taken out of the hospitals, or taken out of their homes in the middle of the night, and even worse. After having worked in this arena for several years, I do not believe that a single child comes out whole after having been in this system. Many foster children make up the homeless population of today. I introduced legislation, Senate Bill 415, in my last session. A substitute bill was written at the last minute by the chairman of the Judicial Committee. All the strong points of my bill had been compromised. An independent audit should be called on every state of all Child Protective Services departments. I'm in touch with congressmen and state officials, and the door may be possibly opening very slowly. A federal congressional hearing is needed. But let me add, due to the hundreds upon hundreds of cases that I've been called to consider, I placed calls to state senators, representatives in their respective states across the country, asking them to help me with certain families. And I was told, if I help that family, or if I help you, I will lose my job. Remove, abolish the federal and state financial incentives, and those are taxpayer dollars. those dollars have been turned, have turned CPS into a business that takes children and separates families for money. Open family court, remove the confidentiality laws, give parents their rights verbally and in writing. I even feel that to terminate the rights of parents, the case should be heard before a jury. Family rights and parents' rights must be protected. We do not need more influence, like the UN's Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's anti-parent, anti-child, and anti-common sense for the family. There has to be perseverance for any great reform, and great reform is needed in this area. How do you tame child protective services? It may be only by closing it completely.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is March 20th, and this is a different type of presentation today, but it's definitely something that I wanted read into the record, if you will, as a resource specifically for parents. So over the years, I have fielded a lot, not cleanly, but I have tried to field lots of questions that have a legal dimension to them. And I am certainly not qualified to deal with that. And I've struggled at times to do proper referral with those questions. So sometimes these questions relate to unschooling, home education in a state that is tough on people who want to work outside of traditional schooling. I get a lot of questions, too, about people struggling with issues that arise around differing ideas for education with people who are divorced or people who are on board with what we're trying to talk about here, but they're co-parenting with somebody who isn't. And remember, too, that the family court system predictably often exacerbates these disagreements between parents, and this can result in rulings that are not really in the best interest of children. And it's with that last part where the organization that we're going to discuss today comes in, the National Association of Parents. This is, I want to be clear up front, a legal organization, not an ideological organization. They do not take specific stances on type of education or parenting styles. They are, you know, working from a legal framework, and that is about protecting the constitutional rights of parents when these intrusions, whether they originate in the schools or the family court system, actually take place. So just to be clear on their mission. But of course, I was very happy to discover National Association of Parents because I'm not in a position to give legal advice, obviously. And number two, I've been frustrated by the fact that I often don't even know where to point people who have these questions. So today on the show, you're going to hear me discuss many of these issues with the executive director and general counsel for the National Association of Parents, David DeLucas. I discovered this organization while I was trying to further develop my understanding of this generation of college students and their behaviors. And this was a follow-up from studying Jonathan Haidt's work on the outcomes of overparenting, of helicopter parenting. And eventually that took me to the National Association of Parents. And then I found out that David has also been a guest on the Tom Wood Show. So I thought in many ways we'd be on the same level. And on the show in the past, we talked in great detail about things like CPS and zero tolerance. And a lot of us look at these stories as they come at us and we say, how do these schools and these bureaucracies not only just keep getting away with the same, but there also seems to be this acceleration? How do they get away with it? Well, it's because they can. There's never been an effective pushback against some of these organizations. And over the last few decades, the problems have gotten progressively worse because of that. So not everybody in the audience is probably a huge fan of everything the ACLU does. But they're right a lot of the time. They're right on a lot of issues. Imagine the last 30 years in the effect on civil liberties if that organization didn't exist. that helps us, I think, understand the challenges parents and families deal with when it comes to the family courts and the schools in 2017. The signal sent to these bureaucracies is they can get away with steadily increasing intrusions. So I wanted this show to be available as a resource. There are options for people who are facing these challenges or even just concerned about facing these challenges. The National Association of Parents is a membership organization. I provided links in the show notes for how you can join. So if today's conversation is impactful for you, I highly recommend checking that out. And I think David's organization is a very important component in the division of labor of promoting educational freedom and a very important resource for parents who might find themselves in peril because of the family court system, because of CPS, or even because of a legal framework that almost enforces helicopter parenting. One of the things we're going to talk about today is CPS cases that get opened against parents who are letting their kids walk home from the park alone. And of course, because so many children are forced into the public schools, and the schools have become increasingly intrusive into the lives of children and families, that's nothing new. You can look at the DARE program all the way back to when I was in middle school. But because of all that, the school is in effect a monitoring and policing force for the family and for the lives of these young people outside of school. And that's a problem as well that affects a lot of people who have not come under the watchful eye unjustly of organizations like CPS or people who have not found themselves unfortunately wrapped up in family court complications. So I think this show is worth a listen for everybody who has children. And if you know anybody who has struggled with the organizations and the problems we're going to talk about in the show today, please send this along as a resource to them. So without further ado, David DeLugas, thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. Hi, David. How are you today?
Doing well, Brett. Thank you for allowing me this time.
Absolutely. So you are the executive director and general counsel for the National Association of Parents. Can you tell us a little bit about the mission of your organization?
Well, the short way to describe it is we're here to protect the constitutional rights of parents. And indeed, a majority of Americans understand that we have constitutional rights. Many have some vague understanding of what those are. Some are a little clearer than others. But there are so many United States Supreme Court decisions that articulate the rights of parents to raise their own children without interference from anybody, from the government in particular, because, of course, that's what the Constitution means, is unless the Constitution has provided a power to the government is not supposed to have that power. Of course, we all know that's not exactly how we're living life in America these days.
Sure.
But the point really is that we're here to protect the rights of parents. And what that means is a parent has a relationship with his or her child. Some are better than others. Some do a better job of parenting. But in a sort of a shorthand way of saying it, we're here to protect the right of a parent to be an adequate parent. But you don't have to live up to some utopian view of the way a person should or must parent. So long as you don't hurt your child, which is what the U.S. Supreme Court has said, you're supposed to have the ability and the right to make decisions for your own child. That's the majority of our mission. Now, as an umbrella organization for married and unmarried moms and dads across the USA, many of whom don't have any issues or problems, we'd like to think of ourselves as an affinity marketing group, an organization that with millions of members, and we're not there yet, mm-hmm. But we'll be in a position to flex a little parenting power, if you will, in the marketplace, both the political marketplace, legislative marketplace, and, of course, the economic marketplace.
Absolutely. Now, you practiced family law for decades prior to the founding of National Association of Parents, right?
That's absolutely correct. Nearly 32 years before this organization came into being, and I founded it after noticing, frankly, becoming more enlightened at what courts are doing and lawmakers are doing to constantly badger and interfere between the parent and the child, because that's really the gravamen of this. What it really is, hey, it's one thing to look after children and try to protect them from being hurt. Constitution doesn't protect the right of parents to hurt their child, as I mentioned a moment ago. But the constant intrusion between the parent and the child, the constant monitoring, the constant oversight with the power of government, which is police power, not just law enforcement, but the court system, juvenile court, the superior courts or the highest court in each state, and of course, Child Protective Services by whatever name it's used. Mm. And let's not forget school systems. And I know your school sucks project. One of the real irritants from a legal perspective is schools having the power to determine whether or not a parent trying to give their child an excuse for missing school is acceptable to the school. And right. Our view, of course, is so long as the parent isn't hurting the child, then the parent should be able to determine whether or not the child is actually at school. So we could get into that in a little more detail and explain it. But frankly, it's one of the places where I think it's the most clear that states around the country are criminalizing the failure of a child to attend school. Whether or not they get educated is a separate issue, and punishing the parents whose children who may be excelling in school but miss school for whatever reason that the parent deems acceptable, but the school does not.
Yeah, the
sorry,
parents
jumped on a tangent there, but I get a little wound up when we talk about these matters.
Absolutely understandable, and like it's a matter ideally for the parent to discuss with their child or for the child to discuss with the parent, and then they make a decision. The school, I mean, just using their own rhetoric, is a service for children and families. I mean, we know there's more to that story, obviously. But you partially answered my question there when I was talking about your history with family law. You described maybe like a gradual accumulation of information or observations about what was happening in the family court system and with CPS and with school. Were there any specific powerful wake-ups to the intrusiveness or the over-involvement of the state with the family?
Absolutely. And actually, I don't think the information was accumulated gradually. I think what it was is my attention to it finally came into focus. I think, frankly, all of us in America are aware of these intrusions, but they become so commonplace, so accepted, that we don't express outrage and battle back as frankly we should. So the answer to your question is yes. In a court case, a divorce case in which I had no involvement, I wasn't one of the parents. I had no relationship to the family. I wasn't an attorney for anybody. But I read about a case in Georgia that went up on appeal. And in that particular case, and by the way, I often try to avoid using mother or father, but instead refer to all parents as parents. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, the father was awarded custody of the two children, a boy and a girl. And the mother's attorney, who had influence with the judge, asked the judge to include a term in the parenting plan which prohibited the father from attending any school function, any athletic event, any event of the children during times that the children were going to be with their mother, and that the mother was willing to not go to any of those events, activities, and such during times the father was going to have the children with him. Now, some may, from a distance, ask the question, well, what's wrong with that? Well, here's what's wrong with that. Courts should not be telling parents when they can and cannot go to events and activities of their children.
Sure.
That are open to the public, in particular open to the public. And as a result of that particular case, which the Court of Appeals in Georgia affirmed, the father appealed that ruling by the judge, and the Court of Appeals affirmed it, saying that the judge had used the magic – this isn't what the Court of Appeals says. This is my way of explaining it. The trial court used the magic words, in order to prevent harm to the children, the father is prohibited from – and the mother is prohibited from, as I just described it. Now, was there any evidence of harm to the children by the mere presence of the father at a Saturday baseball game of the child on a weekend the child was with the mother? Not at all. But if the trial courts, and this is what I've learned in my many years of practice, over 30 years, 35 years now, is judges and lawyers know the magic words. They know the words that will get them past scrutiny and review by an appellate court. And it's a racket. So they control parents through this mechanism of, well, yeah, the Constitution says if you're hurting your child, the court has this power. So they know to say in order to prevent harm. But here's the real, again, down to earth. Imagine it's Friday night in hometown USA, and one of the children plays in the marching band. One is a cheerleader and one is on the football team. Mm. Let's just say this family has three kids. The parents are divorced. But the court has entered such an order. So these three kids are out there, and one of the parents is in the stands, and the other parent's not even in the stadium. But everybody else in town can be there. Everybody else in town is not prohibited from being there. And those children look up in the stands, and they don't see that other parent. And they're left with this emotional reaction of, does my father not care enough? Does my mother not care enough about me to make the effort to be here? Is my parent who is here doing something to prevent my other parent from being here, in which case there's some resentment toward the parent who is there? Or what's wrong with my parent that that parent is not allowed by some court system to come to this activity of mine?
Yeah.
All three are just horrible, horrible thoughts and feelings for a child to experience, when in reality, what I do think courts have may have the power and the authority to implement is some restriction or limitation on the behavior of parents at those events. So if one parent was harassing the other parent, thumbing their nose at them, yelling at them, threatening them, I have no issue at all with courts and security at the stadium and police doing things to prevent that type of inappropriate behavior. But just prohibiting that this parent in this particular case and any other parent in any other case with another judge who is influenced by an attorney to put something in there because his or her client is territorial, because it really came into being because I and this is how parents are in custody situations, that mom may not have wanted to be at a ball game on Saturday and have Johnny run off the baseball field after hitting the game-winning home run, run right by her and go over to his dad and go, "Dad, Dad, did you see what I just did?"
Yeah.
That would hurt her feelings. And in order to prevent her feelings from getting hurt, she wants to prevent the dad from being at the activity where the child wants both parents at that activity.
And was there any dialogue in a situation like that where, you know, the implications of this for the children would be discussed? Because the parent is put into a no-win situation, right? You want to, as a parent, I mean, depending on the age of the children, be honest about the situation. But kids are also getting this message in school of the court is the law is the rule, respect the rules, and these rules have been imposed on mom or dad. And yeah, that question of why, what did mom and dad do? What's wrong with mom or dad to need to have these rules imposed on them? So is there any exploration of that, or does the litigation process kind of block examinations of what's actually good for the children involved?
Well, the answer to your question is, and what most people likely believe, is that the court during a trial or hearing will receive evidence concerning the things you've just mentioned.
Mm.
The welfare of the children, the phrasing, the best interests of the children, and that is going to prevail. But in reality, that's not. And again, I'm speaking as a trial lawyer in family law for 35 years. That's not what really happens. What happens is judges have relationships with attorneys. Attorneys ask for things because their client wants it, whether it's good or not for a child. And the judge ignores evidence from, say, a psychologist or from either parent on these issues. And many of them are not, many of the judges are not parents themselves. Or if they are parents, they may or may not have a real understanding of the parent-child relationship. So the child's needs gets ignored. Now, I've tried to address this through legislation, and I drafted a bill that indicated that a judge would not have the authority to restrict a parent from attending an activity open to the public at which their child was a participant or attending, unless there was specific evidence of actual harm to the child.
Right.
Not mere discomfort and displeasure, because keeping in mind, children whose parents are divorced are likely to experience discomfort if both parents are in the same vicinity, because they'll be afraid. Maybe mom doesn't like dad or dad doesn't like mom. There'll be a little bit of anxiety. That's to be expected. But what we should not do is enable the parents to continue this period of discomfort for either parent or for the children, child or children.
Right.
So the answer, I think, getting back to your question, is the courts think they know better, but the reality is, the U.S. Supreme Court speaks to this, is the assumption is that parents, fit parents, should be allowed to make these decisions, and we shouldn't micromanage. Now, again, I'm not suggesting, and nobody would believe it true even if I did, not all parents are as good, very good at this at all. Some
right.
are downright not very good parents. But there's a difference in not being a good enough parent and having a judge tell a parent, well, because your former spouse is going to be there, you can't go. Because you're absolutely 1,000% correct, if I may exaggerate. Children, like all of us, don't always get the logic. What they get is the message. And the emotional message is just as you said it. If my parent isn't here, maybe there's something wrong with them. And you're right. At any age, children unfortunately get way too much reality of the legal battles their parents have gone through or are continuing to go through post-divorce. And they have an understanding of, well, maybe something is wrong. And particularly if a parent is saying something negative about the other parent in the presence or in the hearing of the child, then add to that the parent doesn't show up at a school play. The child puts those two messages together. My parent's not here. I heard my other parent speak poorly about my parent. That parent is not here. Maybe that's because that parent's something wrong with that parent. And in reality, they're being prevented from that parent's being prevented from attending the event by a court order that was entered at the behest or request of the parent who's trying to be territorial over the child.
Absolutely.
And that's just an unfortunate situation that our courts and our legislators seem to just ignore and say, well, we know better than the parents, so we're going to do it this way. We've always done it this way. It's just a poor excuse for authority on such a level to run over parents and their children.
Well, unfortunately, too, a lot of these parents, you mentioned this earlier in the conversation, don't stand up the way they should or the way that they could if they had the support of an organization like yours. If this has been a pattern in the schools or dealing with CPS or the family court system or all the ways the state intervenes in the family, just like over the course of your career, and maybe you could look back over your career and answer this question, do you see a boiling frog problem here? Are the trends getting clearly worse? Does there seem to be an acceleration in that worsening?
Well, I'm so glad you used the expression, the boiling frog, and I hope every one of your listeners knows what that really means. And it's a great phrase and applicable here. Absolutely.
Okay.
Over time, we in America have become so reliant upon government in so many ways. And then we just take what happens to others and accept it. And as an example, going back to the restrictions that a court will put on a parent, or that CPS imposes. The mere fact that government did it, the mere fact, look, let's all accept this reality. If you're told you're going to sit on a jury and the defendant has been charged with a crime, there's a part of all of us that thinks, well, the police wouldn't have arrested this person and the prosecutor wouldn't have charged this person and they wouldn't be going through a trial unless they were probably guilty. That's just part of human nature in America is we think that. So in applying that same sort of a process, the moment that anybody, a neighbor, a friend, a coworker hears that a person they know, much less a stranger, has some restriction that doesn't allow them to interact normally with their child post-divorce, or that there has been some edict handed down by a school system toward this parent who has apparently allowed a child to miss, quote unquote, too many days of school under the school's attendance policy. And notice I said attendance policy, not education policy, because the focus is on attendance, not necessarily education. There is a vast majority of Americans who then conclude, well, the parent must have erred. The parent did something wrong. There is a reason. They wouldn't just do this for no reason at all. But the reality is, yes, in fact, so many facets of our society through the government, through schools, through CPS as part of government police force, do things they shouldn't be doing. And then we accept it as, well, it's for the children and therefore it's okay. Therefore, we're going to tolerate it because it's for the children. And then the truth is, and where the tension is, hey, if it's for the protection of children, absolutely, let's do it. Let's, in fact, double our efforts and double our resources. But let's not waste any effort. Let's not waste $1 or 1 man-hour of resources towards doing things that aren't designed to protect children from being harmed, but instead are merely designed to placate this sense of, well, we need to be doing this for children.
Yeah. Do you ever worry or ever have any suspicion, because a lot of people have talked this way, there is perhaps a more malevolent mission or underlying philosophy behind CPS. I've talked to people who were CPS whistleblowers, we could say. And, you know, they said this is – it's not like necessarily a conspiracy, but this is an organization that is after federal dollars. And you get federal dollars by having open cases. So there's a CPS whistleblower named Carol Rhodes who wrote a book called Friend of the Court, Enemy of the Family. And she talked about that phenomenon in the book. So I guess there's maybe the bureaucratic problem of it. I'm also wondering if there's anything deeper, and this I don't know the answer to this, but any kind of conflict that the state sees inherent with you know, relationships with the family. Like, is there a subtle battle between the state and the family in some ways for control of children?
The answer is yes, but let me see if I can explain it in the way that I view it.
Sure.
First of all, I will step back one moment and say this. None of us should be terribly worried about identifying what is motivating others to act in ways that are wrongful and that impair and infringe upon our rights and intrude in our relationship between us and our children. Because it doesn't matter why they're doing it. The fact that they're doing it means we need to push back and have them stop doing it.
Sure.
Stop doing it by court cases that are successful and in the volume enough to bring this to a head, similar to the way at one point in time, and it's unimaginable now, blacks couldn't attend the same schools as whites. They couldn't use the same bathroom or water fountains. There was a time when women couldn't vote. There are so many different issues in our society that have been fixed and remedied through a collection of people constantly fighting for a right, and we as parents should do the same thing. So, but that said, let me tell you what's maybe a little less evil, but a little more understandable to us all. If your job is to write traffic tickets, first of all, it's not your job to write traffic tickets. Your job is to enforce traffic parking laws, and you have a citation book, and you walk down the street, and everybody has paid their meter. Pretty soon they're going to say, well, you know what? Maybe we don't need you to work this job because nobody is parking illegally. So you're going to start making sure that you write tickets to show that you're earning your keep. And if you're the only person doing that job, you don't have much upward mobility. There's no job to which you can be promoted.
Right.
So what you need to do is create 20 jobs of people who are writing tickets so that there's two or three supervisors and then a department head. So I actually believe, perhaps naively so, but again, the impact and the effect is the same. If you work for CPS and you're making whatever dollars you're making, you're not going to be considered very valuable unless you're doing something. So you have to go do something. And if what you do creates dollars for your department, that's all the better. But more so, your human nature is, hey, I would like to get promoted. I don't want to work in the same job forever. And the only way to get promoted is to move up. And the only way to move up is if the person above you either leaves or moves up themselves. And the only way that really happens is if the department grows. And the department grows, there are more cases.
Right.
In fact, I can tell you there was a specific instance where a report of a possible abuse of a child fell through the cracks. An investigation was not made, and the child later died from abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible, horrible situation. But the response of our government in all too many situations was just as what the response was in this case. It wasn't a matter of doing an audit, a review, an investigation to determine are the resources already in place adequate to serve and to investigate and to keep children safe. The answer likely was yes. It had just been misapplied in this situation. There was an error made. Fix the error, fix the protocol, fix the procedure. But no, what they did instead was they allocated more money through the legislature, hired more investigators. That's the fix. And then we as a society, unfortunately, tend to go, good.
Yep.
They did something about the situation because they gave more money and hired more people. And in fact, that's not always the best solution. And indeed, we know within the corporate world, that isn't what they would have done. If there were shipments of a product that were defective, they wouldn't just hire more people to build more product. or hire more inspectors, they would find out where, how did this happen, and fix the process so that it could be done more efficiently, more effectively, and have better outcomes.
Yeah.
That's not, and again, as a society, we let that happen as taxpayers, as voters, as people who have the ability to fight back. We don't push back or fight back. So again, I do think there is something to be said about the incentive of federal dollars, because that certainly applies to the mandatory attendance policies across the country, where they are arresting parents because their child missed school, even if their child is an honor student, because they're missing school, and missing school means the school gets less money from the federal government, which awards money and allocates money to school systems based on the number of pupils per school system and the number of days of attendance, which is why, you know, at the end of a school year, they have to make up days if there were snow days or other reasons that school was missed. It's not because the education failed the students. It's because they won't get as much money. So, sure. Yes, as a society, we need to look into all the places where we fix things by putting more money in place, or where there are incentives that are monetary incentives but are not tied to the actual outcomes that we should. So it shouldn't be the number of cases CPS has. It should be the number of cases that are successfully resolved in favor of children being safer without violating the rights of the children or the parents.
Just to return to something you said a minute ago, where we have this bizarre phenomenon that occurs in government, and it's completely alien to, you know, the rest of the world, where when there's massive failures or even the revelation of corruption, the response is more money, hire more people. And people observe this and they say, oh, good. It speaks to the boiling frog problem that we were talking about earlier, because these organizations operate, I think, in the eyes of the public with an assumed benevolence, as if like they don't have the same types of incentives that would be attractive to other people, you know, like more money and more power. So I think that is part of perpetuating the problem as well. I wanted to mention your organization, the National Association of Parents, started in 2013. So this was like 20 years into the zero tolerance phenomenon that goes on in schools today. And zero tolerance is a kind of policing policy in the schools that can be very disruptive to students and families. And I was really surprised to learn that no organization with a similar mission that I could find anywhere existed before yours, in spite of that problem that's happening in the schools. So I wanted to know, like, roughly what percent of your workload is intervening on behalf of parents with the schools?
Candidly, look, I'm going to just be straight up with you. Very little, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
As much as the perception and to some extent reality is, parents don't have much choice about the school to which they send their child.
Sure, right.
The truth is, parents have the same control over their lives as we've had since people landed at Mayflower, off the Mayflower. Meaning, if you don't like the school, either vote for better school superintendent, school board members, and policymakers, or sell your house, or quit renting and rent a house in a different place, homeschool, send your child to private school, whatever. And again, money's an issue. Where you live is an issue. Move across the country, go to a different state, because the policies that are in place are those that the school is imposing. But when you enroll your child there, you're told what those are. And again, I'm not in favor of those. So don't get me wrong about my view or this organization's view. But if you enroll your child with a Little League baseball team, and they have certain rules that say kids can't chew bubble gum while they're sitting on the bench at the baseball games, and you may think that's a stupid rule. Why do you have that rule? If you don't like the rule, you're going to need to start running your own, get involved in the Little League management and see if you can change the rule, or bring a bunch of parents together and seek a change in the rule. Similarly, parents in the school district need to go to the ballot box and vote the school board out, show up at school meetings. But lawsuits, for example, and that's a lot of what we do. We file lawsuits, or we threaten them. We're the ACLU for parents, because the ACLU won't do this work. We're the Institute for Justice, which is a phenomenal organization. I think the world of it. In fact, I contacted them before organizing this entity, because they're doing the same work we're doing, but not in the arena of parent and child. And because of that, that's the only reason this organization was founded. I didn't want to be competing with or sucking dollars away from other organizations. And as you noted, there is no other organization that does this work. But our work is limited to intervening on behalf of parents when the rights of the parents and the relationship with their child is infringed, not because some particular policy, rule, or law is not wise, is not particularly effective, or is counterproductive. Again, zero tolerance, I don't favor it, and I think there are some issues associated with it, but it's not the arena in which we delve, partly because of the demand for all the other areas of, you know, you were likely aware of the instances where children just walking home from the park get stopped by law enforcement. They shouldn't even be stopped. But
yes.
If they are stopped and they're safe, nothing should happen. But instead, a CPS investigation ensues, or parents are charged with a crime of child endangerment. Represented a lady who was on vacation with her children at a beach resort, and when she left to go get food to go, her 9-year-old took a dog out for a walk, and the parent ended up getting arrested for child endangerment. Child was never in danger, and by the way, they did dismiss that case, but the child was never in danger. If they're in danger, then it's from aliens attacking, because there was really no rational, logical danger. But getting back to your question about schools, our belief is that parents need to get more active and involved, that it's not necessarily an area where a lawsuit or a threat of a lawsuit to a school board will change the policy of the school board, because there are too many court cases that empower schools to have certain rules over their campus, over their teachers, over their students, that type of a battle would be more effectively won by a parent with the right attitude and the right perspective running for school board and getting elected, or gathering thousands of parents in that school district who all will share the same view. Somewhat surprising to me, and you may have encountered this too, Brett, is that there are parents who actually think that some of those policies are really good policies, and they're glad they're there in place. They think it's a great thing. So there is a battle between parents. By the way, that doesn't make it right.
Sure.
It doesn't make it wrong. But the issue for our organization is always, is it constitutional, not whether it is a policy or position that we think is a good one or it's not. For example, I personally favor the idea of allowing children, as Lenore Skenazy with Free Range Kids calls it, the free range attitude of parenting. Let your kids go out and run around and play all day. You don't have to be with them every second.
Mm-hmm.
But as an organization, our view is if you want to be a helicopter parent, and unless this is creating long-term psychological harm, and you want to follow your child everywhere the child goes and never let them out of your sight, well, that's your right as a parent. Not may not be good parenting, but it's your right as a parent to do it. You see, and that's the difference, is each of us here has an individual attitude and value system and such. But when it comes to the work we do, we take the view that may not be great parenting, but if it's not parenting that's harmful to your child, causing physical harm or long-term emotional harm per the U.S. Supreme Court, then you should be allowed to do that.
Okay, so let me tell you a quick story about how I came to find your organization. So over the last year, a very interesting segue there, I have been trying to understand this current generation of college students. You've probably seen a lot of the campus protests, the social justice movement. In some cases, it even turns into fighting and fires. And I've tried to approach this from a number of different angles. And I was following up on some research done by a psychologist named John Haid, who talks about a kind of moral dependency that has developed as a result of an overparented generation, what we call helicopter parenting. So
sure.
This is a case that you do deal with in your organization. And what's unfortunate is that we're seeing this impulse. And I just had a guest on my show recently who said, you know, there could be a number of reasons. Actually, it's probably too big a subject to get into here, why people might take this helicopter style approach to parenting. But it is now being reinforced with the law and by CPS. On your case list on your website, you tell one such story where a woman left two children alone to go pick up food at a restaurant. and it wound up being a police investigation. So this is a pretty widespread phenomenon. Lenore Skenazy has been talking about these matters at least going back since I first heard of her 5 or 6 years ago. So now we're actually seeing the people in positions to be intellectual leaders in the next generation, in America of the future, or society of the future, I think in many ways, like, really handicapped by a law-backed, CPS-backed, police-backed approach to over-parenting, right? And while I was investigating this, just following up the work of the psychologist, I found your website, I liked your logo and started reading, and found out you were on the Tom Woods Show, and I've worked with Tom before, so I thought we'd be in the same ballpark as far as ideas go, and I think I was right. But yeah, if you want to speak to that a little bit, because it does seem like this, if a child is outdoors, that is now neglect. Parents have to respond to that in a way that they're trying to prevent legal consequences, and I think that does affect children negatively.
Well, look, I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
I do think there's a negative impact, but from a legal constitutional point of view, it's not whether it's a negative impact and as a society we should avoid this because it's not going to produce leaders and free thinkers for tomorrow. While as much as I believe in it, that's not the basis on which to legislate or litigate in my view. My view is we have to try to create the correct boundaries so as to push back against the overreach of government. And clearly the case you read about is the one I referenced where the mother went out to get food to go.
Right.
And I approach this and I have a 10-year-old son, so I find myself in this mental debate. Do I or don't I allow this? Do I suggest this or go that direction? Because I'm trying to make the best decision for his future, not mine or what makes me happy or what makes me more comfortable or feel more secure, but what's really going to be better for him. And that's what parents should do, and we as a society should embrace that attitude by and large and give parents more rein. I hate to use the word free, but free reign, because we're supposed to be in a society, in a country of freedom and liberty. But that said, I do think that the ongoing, it's as if, I believe, too many parents are allowing the school, allowing law enforcement to set the rules for them because, frankly, they're lazy. It's an easy way to decide what you're going to do and not do. My biggest fear, frankly, and one of the reasons we work hard at trying to educate people and also to litigate these issues, isn't the case of the parent who was arrested because she went out to get food. It's the 50,000 parents across the country who were thinking about going out and picking up the pizza instead of waiting 45 minutes to have it delivered. It'd be quicker, but they don't know whether they should go or not go because their kids are comfortable in the living room watching TV and they're working on their homework. And they're thinking, if I go, I might be violating the law. I might get arrested. I might be under CPS. So it's having a chilling impact. And not, hopefully most of your listeners are familiar with this expression in the law. It's called the chilling impact.
Yeah.
It's the impact when something you learn about occurs. And as a result of that, the easiest way to say it is, if you're driving down the road and all the cars coming the other direction are flashing their lights, I think we all pretty much understand that means there's a speed trap ahead. We all need to be careful, slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, you should follow the speed limit. But in society, the other place this happens is when you start seeing and reading about situations. I had a conversation with a lady I met in the parking lot at the grocery store because she parked. I was about to leave. She parked her car, opened the back door. I'd say her 12 or 13-year-old son was on an iPad, and he didn't seem very anxious to get out of the car. And she was imploring him, pretty much telling him, get out of the car. She was doing it in a nice way, but I got her attention and I introduced myself, told her the organization for whom I work, the National Association of Parents. By the way, the website is parentsusa.org. And I asked her, I said, just curious, given the work I do, is your desire to get your son to go in the store with you because you want his help or that you want him to pick out something while he's in the grocery store with you? Or is there another reason? And I didn't want to lead her and tell her what it was, but she very quickly said, oh, as far as I'm concerned, he's fine sitting in the car, but I just don't want to come out and find out there's a police officer there. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
She should have the freedom to make the decision that given where she lives, given how long she's going to be in there, given the age, maturity, physical abilities of her child, She should decide, look, I have this discussion a lot. Why are we all only concerned with children? If you leave your 70-year-old mother in the car, nobody's going to say boo about it. But maybe they should, because maybe that 70-year-old has dementia, or maybe that 70-year-old has some heart condition, or maybe that 70-year-old has some physical disability that makes it hard for them to move or ambulate, so that if something came up, they really couldn't get out of the car very easily on their own. Why aren't we concerned about that person? In other words, every decision about whether there's a safe a person who's at risk of being hurt should be evaluated based not on the age of the person, but on the totality of the circumstances. Is the person intellectually, physically, emotionally capable of caring for themselves in the situation where they're being left? And is there any imminent danger from something identifiable? Again, not an alien landing or not a kidnapping, which happens so rarely. And again, people could say, well, it could happen. Yes, it could happen. And a meteor could hit you, or an iceberg from the restroom of an airplane flying overhead could land on you. Things do happen, but that's a risk in a free society where we live, because car accidents kill more people every day than virtually any other, to my knowledge, and I've researched this, I'm just speaking off the top of my head, though, than any other source. But we don't tell people to quit driving. In fact, we insist that you take your child who was safe sitting at home, put them in the car, and make them drive with you down the road, where they're at greater risk of getting hurt than if you'd have left them home.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's not the evaluation law enforcement or CPS makes.
Indeed. So I completely understand why your organization approaches the broader problem through the legal and the constitutional framework. It is a broader problem, but it's important to have a division of labor. And, you know, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have a conversation with you, because I hope there can be some alliances built. My show talks about alternative approaches to schooling. If people don't like, as you said, if people don't like what's going on in these schools, I have a very not so optimistic attitude about, you know, being able to change those things in the schools. And there's alternatives outside of that. There's sites that will talk to people about the philosophy of parenting. Lidor Scanese, who we mentioned, my friend, has one called Revolutionary Parent, which is great. There's people who discuss peaceful parenting, all aspects of home education or unschooling. So I had this, your organization was kind of a missing piece, right? Because people ask me questions like your organization fields and deals with, and I'm not equipped to do that. So I was happy to find your organization, and I'm certainly happy to share information with my audience. But if people either find themselves in need of your help, or they just want to check out more of your work, parentsusa.org?
Yes, and look, we are a 501c3. We don't rely upon donations, although we certainly welcome them and encourage them. But what we rely upon is the collective support, financial and practical support from parents. We want to be the organization that is so large in number of members that we open doors, whether it's the governor, the legislators, the head of CPS, the president of the United States, so that similar to the impact that whether you like them or love them or hate them, the AARP and the NRA are influential in America for two reasons. They have a lot of people that are members of each organization and a lot of money. And parents are fragmented. Parents don't organize well. Parents are either afraid to get involved or they're just too busy to be involved. But we want to be the organization that, because we don't take a stance on whether or not you should vaccinate your children, we don't take a stance on homeschooling versus public schooling versus, we don't take a stance on which alternative a parent should do for their family, for their children. We just want to protect the right of the parent to make the decision,
right,
and not have somebody make it for them.
So right.
We hope parents will go to our website at parentsusa.org and will join and become a member for $19 a year and do it in droves. And if there are issues, please email help, H-E-L-P, at parentsusa.org. And what we want is to officially get an email with bullet points of, here's my situation, here's what's going on, this is what bothers me, this is how it's affecting my job, here's a copy of this notice or this order or this letter that we received. We can look at it and respond and say, that's not really a parent constitutional rights issue.
Right.
It is understandable that it's affecting you and it's upsetting to you, but here's what we recommend or suggest, or it's just not within what we can do. Or it is something that we address, here's how we'd like to get some more information from you to take it to the second level of scrutiny before we get involved. And we have been involved and represented people across the country. And as we grow, we'll have more ability to do so, meaning more resources to do so. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. So I, Brett, cannot thank you enough that you've taken the time to get with us and hear about us, and be happy to come back on another day, talk about specific issues. Look, I would like to see all, just a quick one, hopefully be quick. I think the amount of resources across America in school systems, courts, sheriff and police wasted on arresting parents and dealing with truancy if a child is attaining a certain level, grade level and testing level, that they're missing school isn't harming them. Parents should be allowed to do it. And it goes back to the almighty dollar, unfortunately. But I think of all the wasted resources when schools are saying, well, we just don't have enough money. Well, maybe you need to shut down the department that deals with truancy, or make it only apply to the students who aren't doing well in class. They're not learning. And focus on the kids who are missing school and not learning, not on the kid who went on vacation with the family or went to on a business trip with one of the parents, but that child is an honor student, a straight-A student, and yet they're being hassled as well. That's, we need to define why we're doing what we're doing and not use your reference to zero tolerance, not use the same policies across the board without this defining line of, are they successful in learning, in which case their attendance should not be something that we criminalize and go arrest their parent and put their parent into. Look, a parent going to court, not all parents have money. A parent who's arrested, who's an honor student in this school, that the parent was aware of and wrote notes, but the school didn't accept it because a note from home doesn't apply after a certain number of days missed, without a note from a doctor, but going to the doctor when the child wasn't sick or wasn't sick enough, is absurd. Look, we could go on and on about the absurdities that exist in the policies, but this is one where the constitutional rights of the parents is being adversely impacted because, again, there's no harm to the child from missing school so long as they're actually learning.
Right. And I think that what we're talking about and generally in that last piece there is stopping the expansion of the intrusion, right? Like the march just kind of continues. And if we want to have a society where parents and children are more free in the ways their families work and in the way the education of those children will work, the expansion of state power has to stop, and you need a coalition that can effectively fight it. I appreciate you coming on the show, David, and I definitely see more opportunities for us in the future. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Brett, and best to you and the School Sucks Project. I love your name.